Welcome back. We are at Fadley's downtown at Lexington Market. Come on back down, get a crab cake. We're doing some Baltimore positive down here. And I am I'm sitting next to a guy who's got some good basketball game. We'll get to some Wu-Tang, but we got to get to what's going on here because we sort of left this thing with your running for mayor and where that goes. And Don has put together a whole litany of questions. But, the thing that I think concerns – I live at the harbor, guns. Mm-hmm. And – when the Lock Raven thing happened last year, I had a disagreement with somebody on the other side of the aisle about that. Lock Raven sits at the foot of where my facility is. The games that are played there, I hear the cheerleaders, I hear the... And to think that someone was running around that school with a gun, it hit my neighborhood. So I got a little mouthy about it. Quite frankly, it spurred a lot of what we're doing here, Parkland and Sandy Hook and these incredible things that have happened. For you, you've witnessed far more of it than I in the city, and you talk about it from a child growing up, and we're all these years later, and Don, it's our number one topic. I think Don...
Guns. This is not a new topic for you. You've been on this. You've been on this gun thing
for a long time.
For a long time, since the day you were elected. So walk us through. What do we do to make our city safer?
So I think we have to do a couple of things. I think that we're starting to do things, as you know, Don, for the past 2.5 years when I was chair of the Public Safety Committee, I was arguing with the previous mayor about why there was no actual plan to deal with crime in the city.
Yeah, you've been screaming for a crime plan.
Screaming for a crime plan. We finally have one. Actually, on Monday, we're going to make sure that we never go through that point again. I'm putting forth legislation in the council on Monday that will mandate that the mayor's office present a crime plan to the city council at least every 2 years, or update their plan at least every 2 years. However, I think that what we have to do, it goes back to what we were just saying. We've been governed in the same way for 35 years or more, actually, and we can't expect different results, right? When you talk about dealing with crime in Baltimore, for my entire life, it's been solely through the lens of policing. And we know that's not going to work because they put all the eggs in their basket. In my opinion, and this is why so many of them love me, I often say that we are trying to require our police officers to be more than they're actually supposed to be. They're not mental health clinicians.
Yeah, they're not social workers.
They're not social workers. They're not trauma folks. They're not pet wranglers. They're not children wranglers. But that's what we do each and every day. Anytime we have an issue, we pick up the phone, we call 911. To the point, Don, one of the reasons why, they call the officers that are in the cars patrolmen, patrol cars, right? We don't have patrol cars in the city. I'm just going to let you know that now. Because we overburden them with 911 requests. 911 was created when I was a kid. It was supposed to be for what?
Emergencies.
Well, the last time I checked, my kid won't go to school is not an emergency. The last time I checked, there's a school band practicing or a rec center band practicing on my street making noise is not an emergency. My husband is cheating on me via Facebook. Can you come help me? It's not an emergency. There are at least 300,000 calls for service into Baltimore City 911 that would not be handled by a live body police officer and will be handled differently in other jurisdictions.
In your administration?
No, right now. This is what they said to us. They have to. I've been calling for years for them to reduce the amount of calls that they respond to so that the police officers that are in patrol cars have the ability to patrol versus respond from place to place to place. So if you can imagine, we have online reporting now, right, where someone, you go outside, someone's broken the window on your car. You just need the report to get insurance, right? You can type that in. They'll give you a thing like that. You can call in. They can give it to you over the phone. Or we can send an auxiliary officer out. So we have to modernize the police department, right? We have to make sure that they can have the technology they need. We have to make sure that they have the license plate reader units to track cars that are stolen, all that great stuff that we have to do on the policing side. However, we have to have them focus. We can't go back to the days where, when I was growing up as a young man who was just happened to be outside and ended up in the back of a paddy wagon just because they wanted to ask me questions, because back then, it wasn't people talk about driving while black. It was breathing while black. If you were outside in my neighborhood and something happened, they were grabbing everybody. No matter if you're
roundup time.
Roundup. You playing basketball, it happened up the street. What you see? You didn't see nothing. Oh, you saw something. Boom, get in the back of this car until you tell them something. Even if you have to make something
up. We got a dead body over here, right? So somebody,
None of that.
No. Okay.
Mysteriously, it was never around when the dead bodies came. However, You have to understand that you have to fix that issue, and you have to have them focus. They know that we know in Baltimore City that most of the violence is committed by small groups of people on other small groups of people. So they have to have what we call a group violence reduction strategy, where they're focusing in on them.
Gangs?
The violent repeat offenders. Yeah, some people call them gangs. And that's it. In Baltimore, I would say we just call them crews, right? Because there are people who are stood on the corner of Park Heights and Wiley Avenue. It's much like sports. You're a sports guy, right? The Ravens came here. They used to wear orange in Cleveland. They came here and wore purple. You know, Michael Jackson, the first receiver everyone knows from the right. Ravens, he was a Brown. He was no different when he came here than when he was in Cleveland. He still caught the ball, right? That young man who stands out on that corner on Wiley and Park Heights, he used to wear red, he was a Blood. He went to wearing blue, as a Crip. He went to wearing purple, he was in Purple City. The problem is he was still doing the same thing. I don't care what color jersey they have on. I'm concerned about their sport. Their sport is killing people. Focus in on those people who are actually causing the violence, removing them from the neighborhoods. That's what we need them to do.
Well,
in addition, Don, I think that it's also important that we remember we're talking about guns. But when we talk about guns, unfortunately, other than myself and a few others, we never talk about the actual guns themselves, only the people that are using them. So what we did is, a few years ago, I went to the Mayor's Office of Criminal Justice Police Department, asked them to create this Gun Crime Intelligence Center, where we were going to be a part of the federal thing where they track every gun, every bullet, every back to its origin. And what they presented to us, and we had ATF in this hearing as well, is that a good bit of the guns that they recover are not only coming from outside of Baltimore City, they're coming from outside of the state. And we have this thing in Baltimore, as you know, a gun offender registry. So people who commit crimes with guns, all of these things, they are gun offenders, and there's a whole process for that. However, if Don is trafficking 50 guns into the city and they catch him, Don is not a gun offender. That's crazy to me. If we're trying to combat this war, this violence, war of violence that we have in the city, we have to deal with the people that are pulling the trigger, but we also have to stop the flow of guns into the city. We have to have stricter penalties for people who are straw purchasing. You know, it's actually, until my bill that I just introduced will be passed, someone who sells a gun to a child in Baltimore isn't a gun offender. Someone who buys
They will
it,
be under your
they
bill.
They will be under my bill. Someone who...
How is that possible? What kind of city are we running?
Hey, well, look.
Because, I mean, as a citizen, I ask
yeah,
that a lot.
I'm with you.
I walk through the street.
Because we've only ever focused in on the people committing the violence with the gun. It's flabbergasting to me, Nestor, because I always say, as someone who talks with cops all the time, they say, well, we don't get it either, but we have to follow direction. When they go out and they catch some kid who's selling a little bit of drugs, they don't care about that kid. What do? They flip him up to the big fish. But when they catch somebody with one or two guns, they don't flip him up. They just say, okay, this gun's used in a crime. Boom, you're going to jail. We have to...
Not where did you get it.
Not where did you get it. Because we were just talking about how hard it was for me to get from Park Heights to Northeast Baltimore to go to high school. We know that some young man, 20, 25 years old, in West Baltimore can't get to West Virginia to buy a gun. We know that. So we have to deal with the flow of guns as well. But the most important thing that we have to do is we have to understand that gun violence is a disease, and we have to deal with it from a public health standpoint. It's an epidemic. We have to do it through the health department, do it through organizations like THREAD, Center for Urban Families, our school system, recreation and parks, so that we're preventing young people from getting in it. We have to deal with the day-to-day violence. We have to deal with the people that are doing it. We have to create pathways for reentry, because reentry and the way that the state actually rehabilitates people is a joke.
I hear that at every level.
It's a joke.
We can get into the governor and the red line and all
that. Let's pick up on that. Yeah. Tell us why it's a joke.
Well, this is why, to me. When you go into prison, right, the whole purpose of the prison system is supposed to be rehabilitate so that when you come home, you don't reoffend. Right? And I went through this with the young man that robbed me, right?
Who you went and argued for leniency.
Yeah, I did. I did. Because, one, he was 16.
Tell us that story. I haven't. I'm sure you've told it a million times. My audience may not have heard it.
So, irony, growing up in Park Heights, I saw a lot of violence, saw a lot of crime. I was never the victim of it. Until I moved to my nice, quiet neighborhood in Northeast Baltimore, where I live now.
In Frankfort.
I hadn't even been there a year. And I'm coming home, and it's a day in September. The Colts is a Monday night. The Colts are playing on Monday Night Football, I remember. And then I get robbed by two young men. Who were young men. I never even go to court. They get sent away. Found out last summer that they were still in jail.
Can I ask you? So they robbed you at gunpoint. You had whatever little you had. How did they get caught?
So this is the true story.
What happens? You get robbed. You call 911, right?
Actually, I just called the police directly. But yeah. So what happens is I get robbed. I call the sergeant. And my post officer, because I was working in the city government at the time. And they come.
You're working for Stephanie?
Yeah, I was a community liaison. Okay. And they come, and, you know, the post officer, who's actually a sergeant now, says immediately, I think I know who it is. And then what ends up happening, like, the next day, they catch one of them. The young man that I end up helping doesn't get caught for, like, a year later. And what ends up happening is they call me. They say, you know, they're going to jail for this time. I never even get to face them in court, right? You're supposed to face what happened. So we never had that conversation until I went to visit him in prison. And it is the best thing I've ever done in my life.
Where was he?
He was out in Hagerstown.
What do you know about this young person?
So I know that he has totally changed his life around. He has actually taken advantage of the programming, some programming that they do have in prison. And this is what I think people have to understand. And they can learn from my experience. Because I was 25 when that happened. I'm 35. He was 16. He's 26. I'm not the same man I was when I was 25. I had a totally different view on the world. I've grown so much. And thinking back to when I was a 16-year-old Mervo.
Well, you know you're different, right?
Different.
Yeah.
Different. So for him to then go in there, to have to get his GED, all of that stuff in there, and I'm one that says, look, you have to penalize people for their crimes. I do think that we have to rethink the way we deal with juveniles, right, because of how their brains form. That's a conversation that we need to have. But when I went to see him, and he just talked about how sorry he was, and I talked about even, like, how sorry
you weren't the only person he robbed, or am I nuts?
So, listen, I
don't think you just get a gun and go rob somebody once, put it down, and never do it again.
But you also have to think about the situations, right? When dad not around, mom's always working and struggling to provide, like that kind of stuff that leads up, get caught up with the wrong person, upset at the world. And now for him to, and I don't want to say publicly all the stuff he said, to say how sorry he was, but how much he's grown, and I could see that, right? And for me to finally get closure, because I didn't have closure.
You felt violated.
No, it felt violated. And I had long ago forgiven him for what happened. But when you face someone man to man, you can look them in the eye and have that conversation, it changes the way you look at the world. And then that's what makes me also have a better connection, because I know that he's going to have me when he comes home. And his family, when he comes home, to try to help him. But even going through all the programs and things that he did, we should be having programs in our system where they're getting certified to do HVAC, right? My dad and my cousin should teach
these
that.
These are jobs. This is
jobs
career.
When they come home.
Yeah.
Knowing, especially because, again, I'm data-driven. Knowing that Sandtown Winchester has more people returning home to prison than any other place in the state, we should be saying, okay, this is what's happening. We have all, especially those who have violent crimes. If we don't want them to reoffend, Don, wouldn't it be smart of us to say, all right, these are the people, they're going to be going home in the next 2 years, the next 3 years. While they're here, we're going to get them the GED, train them up into this trade, so that when they come home, partnering with the Mayor's Office of Employment Development, with our workforce people, when they come home, boom. They go right to working in some job, right? That's the great worker center.
Because we know now it's so difficult to get a job when you
there
come out.
There you go.
It's the system is stacked against you.
And then what happens if you don't provide that, if they know that they can't get a job and every job they get is paying them, you know, $10, $11 an hour. They got kids. They got back child support from when they were in there. So now their check that was $800 is now $200 and $300. We're not leaving much choice. They got to do something. They can't. Some of them struggle to get a license, so they can't drive Uber or Lyft. They can't afford a car. You know, we have to invest in rehabilitating, right? Yes, they have to serve their time.
Well, they're
going to
be your citizens, yeah. My citizens,
when they
our
come home.
Citizens.
Yeah.
And I walk through the harbor. I walk through Lexington Market. These are the people we're bringing back here.
Yeah.
And the prisons are broken.
Yeah, we have to fix that.
You care deeply about these issues, and we're really scratching the surface, and hopefully throughout the campaign you can come back and we can talk more in depth. But I want to go back again. When you talk, you just ooze passion about these issues. You care about that young man in Hagerstown. You want his life to be different. To those who say, Brandon's a nice young guy, he should just bide his time and stay in the city council and, you know, years down the road he can run. And you say time is now. Why?
Well, time is now because I can't wait because Baltimore can't wait, right? That's the truth. The city needs transformational and generational change leadership right now. And then also what I say to them is that when they go back and tell a 30-something-year-old Dr. King that he shouldn't give the I Have a Dream speech, would they go back and tell Jesus, who died at 30-something, that he shouldn't go and lead people into the promised land in a way, better way of faith? Would they go back and tell Johnny Olszewski that he shouldn't run from county executive? Or
they probably did.
They probably did, but they were wrong. Would they go back in 1999 and tell a young councilman named Martin O'Malley, who, by the way, same age range that I am, less experience in city government than I have now, would they go back and tell him, no, in 1999, you shouldn't run for, you should wait, you should become, he didn't even become city council president, he just went straight. So what they should understand is that, one, I may be 35, but I have a lot of experience. Not experience, yes, we know that I've been in city government since September the 4th of 2007, but also, I have the experience in Baltimore. I have the educational experience. And what we need in our city is someone of my generation who's ready to say, okay, it's our time.
What do you do in one of Nestor's favorite questions? You're there. You're elected. It's day one. What is the first month of a Scott administration look like? What do you do?
The first month is something I talk about all the time. In order for Baltimore to move forward, Baltimore has to do something very uncomfortable that we have refused to do for far too long. We have to take a look in the mirror at city government, top to bottom. We have to start assessing every single, I'm going to bring everyone in, assessing every single thing that we do immediately after appointing a city administrator, by the way, to run the day-to-day
operation. Like every other county.
Like every other county, every other city known to man.
Is there anybody that's going to run without a city administrator in your mind? That seems to be a very popular concept.
I don't know. They might. They might, but we're going to pass the bill, so it won't matter if they run on it or not. But Nestor, what happens is we're going to go top to bottom. Day one, we're going to start assessing everything the city government does, looking at all of our policies, our practices, everything down to how much office space we do. Because in order for Baltimore to move forward, we have to change the way we work. Look at everything that's right, even down to how many people are doing each job, reassigning people to make sure that we are putting forth a government that is best for all of Baltimore. And then what I'm going to do as mayor is that I'm not going to be what we've had, unfortunately, is some mayors who wanted to be the smartest person in the room, right? As a coach, you always know that the coach isn't always the best coach. Mike Krzyzewski, yeah, he's known now for having the best players, but he didn't always have that, right? Think about what Harbaugh did with the Ravens. The Ravens didn't have the best talent the last time they won the Super Bowl. But what they did is they put the best, the smartest people for their role in those positions and allow them to flourish, and that makes you look like you're a genius. I'm going to surround myself with the smartest and the most talented, a wider range of young minds, experienced minds, new innovative minds, so people that we can move the city forward and work collectively on one goal and allow those agency hits to shine and be great in their own right.
Do you go back in some form or fashion and recreate, whether you call it CityStat, CompStat? Do you go back and be more data-driven?
Absolutely.
Which was certainly the hallmark of the O'Malley administration.
Absolutely. Everything is going to be data-driven. everything. CityStat, we're going to have that. ComStat, the police department has it. We're going to make sure that they're doing that. Everyone's going to have metrics, and they're going to be held to that. Our city administrator will be leading those efforts and making sure that we are being accountable and transparent at every turn.
Where are you with Fraternal Order Police and what's going on here, consent decree? You know, I've seen and felt the city change and the feeling of safety over the last, the perception, but really the reality of what goes on with dirt bikes rolling through the city on Sunday afternoons for a decade now downtown, and perceived safety issues, and then the reality of the safety issues.
So I think this is what the conversation that I've had with my friends at the FOP and my friends at the police department. When we have this consent decree, the consent decree doesn't say that we can't police in Baltimore. It just says that we can't do it the way that happened to me when I was a young kid, or happened to so many people that led to that. However, there's been a failure of communication. The police administration and this new commissioner is now trying to correct that, hasn't communicated down to the officers on the street how they have to do their job, what the plan. Again, of course crime is going to go crazy when you have a plan to fight crime, right? We have to get back to having that in community. And yes, there will be fights. There are going to be things that the FOP wants to do that the police administration doesn't want to do, and vice versa. But what I will always have is, they always know for me, everyone will be able to come to the table and be brought to the table. Everyone's voice will be heard and respected. Because what we have to have, Nestor, is we have to have buy-in on every level, right? And when I hear, and so I spend a lot of time talking to our police officers, look, we just want to know how we should go about doing our job. What should we should be doing so that we can have the city be a better place? But again, that also goes back to doing something that I just talked about earlier. And again, just now, listen, you'll hear people say that, oh, you need 3,000 cops in the city. They don't know how many cops they need, Nestor, because the police department hasn't assessed themselves in decades.
Well, the FOP,
we also
does
have citizens calling to, right, you know, we were overwhelming the police. Yeah.
But
do
the
have
FOP does say, right, that they're, so you're not, you're saying we don't know whether they're 500 understaffed,
no,
which
well,
is what
this,
they say.
So this is, they're 500 staff based on the model that they've been working on, which is an outdated model. And that I think that they would agree that there needs to be a big assessment of that, right? And some of the things that we talk about, and you hear me talk about, for example, 2 years ago, and this is one of the reasons why I've been fighting for the city council, like the county council, to have legislative authority over the police department, because we don't, which is a unique situation. It's the only one controlled by the state. However, what we need to do is understand this. 2 years ago, they were 300 short based off the previous shift contract that the commissioner negotiated. However, when we asked them a simple question at a hearing, it's like, well, how many police officers do you have doing jobs that civilians would do in other departments? Guess how many they said? 300. So that was the shortage right there.
So then you could get 300 officers right
on
the street.
So they're starting that process now. But they're also, through the consent decree, starting an analysis process of the department top to bottom. Because you also, we passed the legislation that I've been fighting for, that actually Governor O'Malley fought for when he was a city council person, to redraw the boundary lines for the police districts or precinct lines that haven't changed since 1959, which is the year my dad was born.
Populations change a little since then.
Yeah, so you have one district, the Northeast District where I live, that has 130,000 people in it, and none of the other nine have 100,000 in it, based off the census. So when you're policing
allocation,
now that will be done off population data, calls for service, violent crime, you know, property crime. That will be done every 10 years with the census starting now. But this analysis will tell us how many people they need in each area, where they have too many people, so that we can get the police officers the support that they need out on the street, out of headquarters. That's what we have to do. That's tough work. It's hard. They should have done it a long time ago, but it's underway now so that we can have a better path forward. But in the meantime, we do need that immediate action. We need them focused in on the violence, the people committing the violence, and not giving them direction on what to do.
Well, I know we got to take a quick break, but before we do, Nestor, Mr. President, just not long ago, over Labor Day weekend, 20 people shot. Three more killed, teenagers, young kids being shot. 300 murders. Are you encouraged by Commissioner Harrison's actions so far, and what do we do to stop this madness? I mean, you've alluded to it, but it just goes on and on and on, and it just seems to be so pervasive.
Yeah, so I think that we have a plan now, and my duty as the council president and the council's job is to hold them accountable for that plan. We can't direct them to do anything. We are pleased that that plan includes a lot of the things that we've been calling for, including civilianization, including the analyzation, including a focus on violent repeat offenders and group violence. However, what I think we need right now is we need more immediate action. And these are the conversations that I'm having with them about how we can have more partnerships and do things in other ways. Because it also, again, this is not just simply a policing problem, right? This is why, of course, you know, I led demonstrations and had my own violence initiative in the city to deal with things in a different way. We have to understand that when you have 2.5 years of no crime plan, you're going to have chaos in the streets. And now we have to do the tough work of getting that cat back in the bag, so to speak, because that's the worst thing ever, man. As someone who's had to go to homicide scenes where young people were killed, speaking at the funerals of young people, you'll never forget. I'm always, even from violence or even fires, small caskets and churches full of crying teenagers is something that's going to stick with me for the rest of my life, right? It traumatizes me. When you have that, you have to get to a point where we all say we got to stop this and we have to do things in a different way, or we can continue to see what we have.
Nestor, we come back. Let's talk about education, a few other things. We got one more segment. Where are we?
We are at Fadley's. We're down here at Lexington Market. We're all getting hungry for crab cakes. And we'll be back. Baltimore Positive from Fadley's with City Council President Brandon Scott and mayoral candidate and county executive as well. I got to give titles today.